This is The Guardian.
I'm Laura Murphy-Oates, and this is The Full Story. If you've ever tried to use a mobile phone outside of a major city in Australia, you would know that regional Australia has a problem with connectivity, which essentially means the ability to make calls or access the internet. Being able to do this is pretty important in modern life, especially for things like running a business, learning at school, and connecting with family. Also, as you're about to hear, when an emergency comes along, the ability to make a call can become a matter of life or death. Today, Australia's problem with mobile phones. It's Tuesday, the 16th of November.
When we first started dating, Hannah used to say to me, "Oh, how come you're not answering my messages? You know, you didn't." I said, "Well, that's because I've got no service." I said, "I can only reply once I get back into service."
I was a bit sus, yeah. Having moved from Sydney. Surely you can get my messages any time of day.
This is Hannah and Will. They live in the regional New South Wales town of Bigger, about 2 hours north of Canberra.
I'm William Picker. I'm a fifth generation farmer at Bigger. I'm 42 years old. I'm going bad.
You want to start again?
Yeah, you start first.
I'll start. Okay.
Sorry.
Hannah is a journalist and Will is a farmer.
I'm Hannah Sparks and I'm 30 years old. I moved to the New South Wales Southern Tablelands in 2018 to work for a local newspaper and met Will.
So how long have you guys been together then?
Coming up on 3 years. We met at the Binder Picnic Races, which is, you know, true country-style
event. Country race meeting.
Yeah.
I thought she was very nice. She's very friendly. I didn't realise she was from England to start with. I didn't really pick up on her accent. But, just very bubbly and beautiful person.
Oh, it's nice. Always nice to hear, isn't it?
Hannah and Will now live together on Will's farm, with his parents living close by. The closest town is only 1.5 kilometres away, but life on the farm can still feel pretty remote. The property, with all its paddocks, extends out for about 14 kilometres. A year ago, around wintertime, Will was out working in one of the far paddocks.
Yeah, I was going along, mustering in a mob of sheep into a set of sheep yards, and they broke away, and instead of, I had my dog on the back with me, she sits on a little box on the back. Instead of sending her out around them, I decided to try and go a bit faster than get around them myself. And as I did that, I come over a bit of a rise and a drop off. And once I got over the crest, I noticed a big wombat hole at the bottom. And yeah, it was too late to avoid it or do anything. I sort of just had to go with it and hope for the best. And as I hit the hole, yeah, the bike went from about 45 kilometres an hour to zero in, yeah, a split second. And that just crunched me and spat me over the top of the bike. And I sort of hit my head on the handlebars. And then I remember hitting the ground and I just heard this snap and felt just instant burning pain sort of thing in my back.
What was going through your head in terms of your injuries and the type of risk that you were in at that moment?
I thought, ooh, you've done something to your back, so, you know, you can still move at the moment, but just lay still in case, you know, you do more damage. And I had my phone in my pocket, so I got it out after a little while. It was cold and frosty and got my phone out, no service. And I thought, you know, I could do the emergency 000 at all times, but that didn't work.
Wow.
I tried all these different numbers. I think I even tried 911 at one stage, just hoping. Because, I was in quite a bit of pain.
Will lay on the ground contemplating what to do next. His phone was out of service and no one knew which paddock he was in, so it could take hours for anyone to find him. He realised he had to move, find somewhere in reception and get help. and the closest spot was about 300 to 400 metres downhill from where he lay.
I started crawling and that was pretty painful, so I thought I'll try and stand up. Couldn't get to my feet. So then I just kept crawling down the hill and took me a fair while to get down there, but I finally made it to the spot that I wanted to and got down there and still no service on my phone. I don't know where to go now, so I thought I'll try and head up on top of a hill. So then I started to crawl up the hill and I had to go over a creek as well. The water was only, you know, probably about 10, 15 centimetres deep or something, so it wasn't huge, but yeah, it's still slippery rocks and that it wasn't nice. It was very painful crawling and got probably about 3/4 of the way up to the top of the hill. I was constantly checking my phone every, you know, 30 seconds or something like that. I'd have a look to see if I had any service. And yeah, finally got enough. And so I rang Hannah. It wasn't the best service in the call, but it was enough to get the message through that I'd hurt myself.
It was lucky that I even saw my phone ringing because I think I had it on silent on the bed. We're talking, yeah, early, first thing in the morning at this stage. And I saw my phone ringing and, you know, answered like I normally would, hey, what's happening? Is there something you've forgotten that you need me to bring down when I come down? For he just said, I've had an accident and I need you to come and get me. And my memory is that the phone cut out after that. I remember going into sort of all stations go mode.
Hannah and Will's dad, plus a neighbour, began driving around the area that they thought Will was in to try and find him.
So we're off on the road, just looking, keep jumping out of the car, shouting Will's name. Maybe after about 10 minutes, I heard Grant sound the horn of his motorbike a few times and we headed in that direction. But none of us had mobile service still. So then we sent Grant up to the house to call an ambulance.
When you found Will, what did he look like?
He was laying face down on the floor. He looked pretty pale and I could see that he cut his forehead. There was blood on his forehead. I didn't even know what type of injury he'd had at this point, and I was trying to ask him what had happened and he kept just saying, my back, my back.
Will was then helicoptered out by first responders. It wasn't until later that they found out how close a call this was for Will.
If you have a look at the x-ray with the fractured vertebrae, yeah, lots of small little bits of fracture, and if they moved, you know, millimetres, and if one of those floating bits of vertebrae had touched his spinal cord, then he was looking at spinal cord damage. I mean, it was a really serious back injury.
Probably still not fully recovered now, to tell you the truth.
If you had both had phone reception for that day, how different would it have been?
I think for me it would have been less traumatic because I could have stayed on the phone getting that initial phone call and then not being able to speak to him again. What if I got there and those have been our last words to each other?
So, Gabby, I spoke to Hannah and Will about the lack of connectivity in the area and how they believe that actually put Will's life at risk. That's a very dramatic example of this issue, but is this type of problem common about mobile reception in regional Australia?
Yeah, look, I think it is, Laura.
Gabrielle Chan is Guardian Australia's rural and regional editor.
And I think part of the reason is that expectations have built that we can get coverage. So I live in out of a town called Harden. It's about 90 minutes west of Canberra. So we're classed as inner regional. So when I came to the farm in 1996, everyone was using two-way radios. Mm. So mobiles weren't around. That was the only way you could communicate. And as mobiles became more and more mainstream and to the point where now, you know, we use our mobiles more in this area, or we try to, I think this expectation has been built that we should be able to use them all the time.
We sat down as a family, so Will and I and his parents, after the accident. I think I was probably feeling particularly anxious about a similar situation happening again, and just discussing making sure that Will and his dad, who's now 80, he was 79 at the time, always have a two-way radio when they go out. But even those don't always have reach.
You live in regional Australia. Can you tell me a bit about that and just give me some examples of how this issue plays out in your day-to-day life?
I work at home now. I used to work in the Parliamentary Press Gallery, but I've been working at home for probably the last 4 years full-time. And, you know, just call dropouts. I can lose my calls probably 7 times, I think, is my record on the same call of dropping out. Hotspotting from my phone is tricky on my computer, so I'll often go into town to work.
Yeah, it's very, very stressful and annoying. Trying to run the business here on the farm, now there are a lot of good apps out there for your phone that to make the job a lot easier in managing your stock and everything like that, and just not being able to access them. Until you get home and you're on Wi-Fi that night, it just slows everything down. And even when you're trying to make business calls and just sort of dropping in and out, can't hear people and, not very good.
If I'm down the house and I need to ring Will to say I'm going to the shops, does he want anything or something along those lines, I can tell how close to the house or far away he is, whether it goes to voicemail or not. And we rely on Wi-Fi calling and we still have a landline in the house. So sometimes in the house, if the internet goes down, you can only really get 4G if you're in a particular spot in the house. So then you've got to go to your landline.
All of this is happening at a time when more and more people are literally moving to the regions to get greater lifestyle benefits, and because their workplaces have recognised that they can work from home. And so I think this is going to become more and more of an issue as people with even greater expectations possibly than regional Australians move to areas where they're thinking, why doesn't my phone work here? Or why does my phone work in this town and not that town, which is often the case.
So why is mobile phone coverage and connectivity so bad?
I spoke to the RMIT professor, Mark Gregory. Now, the reasons that it is bad, the way it was explained to me, is it depends on the capacity through the mobile phone network, right? So I can have good connectivity at quieter times of day, but when everyone starts working, when everyone starts talking on their phones, starts meeting, using their data, that's when things get bad. It's like you and I are in a room, and if there's just the two of us in the room, it's easy to have a conversation. The more people you pack in that room, the harder it is. And so that capacity to talk to one another gets harder the greater the traffic going through that mobile base station.
Do we have any sense of how bad this issue is of connectivity around Australia, of what places are experiencing this the worst, really?
We don't. We have a couple of things going on. So the federal government does a 3-yearly regional telecommunications review, which is currently, submissions have finished now, but those submissions will be coming up pretty soon in the public domain, and they will report by the end of the year. It does important work in the sense that people can write down their grievances and send them into the committee, and you get a lot of submissions from companies and from national industry bodies like the National Farmers Federation. But essentially, without really clear performance data, you know, I think of it as a kind of tea and sympathy, because if you can only get anecdotal data, you can't prove any of this.
Do the government or the telcos share any data on this or collect any data on this to the public, where your phone will or will not work?
The telcos keep that internally to know how their network is working, but the federal government doesn't mandate that we have to see that. We have a thing called a coverage map, but as I understand it, it's a predictive map. So if you Google your telco provider and coverage map, then you will find a map that has a picture of Australia, and it'll have, you know, probably depending on your which provider you use for Telstra, most of Australia is covered.
Mm.
But then when you drill down into that map, which I did, you can find all these little parts that aren't covered, because the greater you bring the resolution of the map up, the more that you can see that it's patchy.
Mm.
Another thing that they have is the National Black Spot Map. And essentially, MPs can report on regional locations with very poor or no coverage. The telcos also can self-report, and then funding rolls out of that. So that is a way of trying to plug those gaps that I was talking about in that coverage map.
Is there any way of getting better data on this? Is anyone trying to capture it at all?
So Professor Gregory decided to look at this himself, and part of the reason he's so driven is because he spent a lot of time growing up in regional Australia.
Hmm.
He really wanted and believes fervently that regional Australians should have, you know, equal services as metropolitan Australians. And he found across all the areas he studied, which included South Australia, Northern Territory and Western Australia, that the average connection speeds were between 0 and 10 megabits per second download and 0 to 2 megabits per second upload.
Mm.
So if you compare that with your average usage in capital cities, you know, it's pretty woeful.
Yeah, woeful and common, it sounds like, across a vast area of Australia.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Next, one politician's solution to solve the problem of connectivity in regional Australia. Is this something that lies at the feet of telecommunication companies, or is it also a state government or a federal government issue?
The history of telecommunications in the country, you would have to understand before you can answer that question.
Not that long ago, making the simplest call from some corners of Australia wasn't always that simple. In fact, it sometimes called for a good deal of ingenuity.
So we had Telecom back in the olden golden days, right, which was a government-owned entity.
I don't know about you, but I think we should be sticking with the 100% Australian phone company. Hey, mate. And that's our Telecom.
And so the government, federal government, was responsible for this beast called Telecom.
Mm.
And so we had this expectation that this was a government service, right?
Telecom's ongoing commitment to all Australians.
Thank you, Mr. Deputy Speaker. On behalf of the Minister representing the Minister for Communications, the Information Economy and the Arts, I present the Telstra Transition to Full Private Ownership Bill 1998.
So Telecom is privatised.
This bill is about the government delivering on its promises. We made crystal clear in our election policy that if elected, we would introduce legislation to sell one-third of the Commonwealth's equity in Telstra by way of a share.
That caused angst, particularly in regional areas, who knew that it wouldn't be very economical to provide telecommunications to rural and regional areas.
Within this legislative framework, the government has included a number of specific measures to ensure that Australians living in rural and remote regions share in the benefits of improved and cheaper communications. The Minister for Communications, the Information Economy and the Arts will shortly approve Telstra's Universal Service Plan, which provides for reduced maximum connection times and greater general transparency and accountability. A ministerial determination.
And so we get this thing called the Universal Service Obligation, which basically means that the federal government mandates that every Australian should be able to get access to a landline to their home or a payphone in your main street or close to where you live. And the problem is it hasn't caught up with mobile phones. Mobile phones have leapt over the top of that, and it means that mobile phones aren't really covered by the USO. And so that's one of the things that there's a lot of debate over, whether that should be part of the current federal government responsibility to mandate. This is a question of whether telecommunications are an essential service. And bodies like ACAN, which is the Consumer Communications Network, would say, you know, it should be an essential service. You know, it's an essential service in Queensland, but that's it.
Wait, so it's only an essential service in Queensland. What does that mean, Gabs?
Well, in Queensland, all telecommunications are considered an essential service by legislation, but no other state has passed that sort of legislation. That becomes so important. We've just spent the last 2 years mired in raging bushfires. We went into floods after that, and then we've been in the pandemic ever since. So this is, again, comes back to expectations. Can we, as a very large country of Australia, can we have the same telecommunications as a highly populated place like Europe, where you can land, pick up your $10 SIM from the airport and connect to any tower, no matter who the provider? These are very different landscapes, and I think that's at the heart of the frustration of mobile phone users. And also, to be honest, at the heart of the frustration of some of the telcos who are saying, look, we can't get a signal to every single piece of landscape in Australia.
So, Gabby, is the government doing anything about this to try and fix this connectivity issue in regional areas?
Yeah, well, it's obviously got the Mobile Black Spot program that we talked about earlier, and that's in partnership with the telcos.
Just on the Black Spot program, you know, you can sense the frustration in town because there is a bit of rivalry between the villages that receive the funding. So Reed's Flat, which is, how far is Reed's Flat from here? 20-minute drive.
Yeah.
They've got a tower, and you hear people in the pub talking about it. Well, how come Reed's Flat's got a tower and we don't? So it is interesting how some places get the opportunity to get access and others don't.
The government also has a regional connectivity program, which is essentially a grant program that funds telecommunications infrastructure projects. Compared to global spending in regional areas, the government does spend a lot. In Australia, it's just so big. We are such a big country.
So, Gabby, outside of these two programs that you just mentioned, I mean, what more could be done? Is there appetite to fix this problem on a broader level?
Exposure draft of some legislation to hold the telecommunications companies accountable for their underservicing of communities right across Australia.
One of the people who decided we do need some major reform is a Liberal MP and backbencher Julian Lisa.
This bill, in its draft form, encourages the telcos to improve their service, ensuring that anybody can use their mobile phone in their home or in their business, ensuring that there is proper accountabilities for the appalling customer service the telecommunications companies give to our constituents.
He's done a very unusual thing of bringing a private member's bill to his own government to change fundamentally many of the regulations around telecommunications.
But this bill is designed to do three things. It's designed to give us better infrastructure, it's designed to force better customer service on the telcos, and it's designed to force better accountabilities on those telcos. Telecommunications is a fundamental service that Australians rely on, but in many respects we had better telco 20 years ago when we all had landlines, because at least you could make a call from inside your house.
Under this bill, the universal service obligation, that thing we talked about before, would be extended to mobiles for the first time. Lisa's proposal would also only allow telcos to claim they provide mobile coverage in the relevant area if the device can be used in most of the homes or businesses. And anyone who's left without service at their home or business for more than 6 hours between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. over a month would get a month of free service from the provider.
Right, so good mobile coverage in your home or business or your money back, really. What else is in this bill?
Well, the bill includes a new customer service guarantee ensuring no caller to a telecommunication company would be left on hold for more than 5 minutes. That's a pretty hard ask. And probably the most significant part of this bill is that it would make bonuses paid to telco executives contingent on demonstrable improvements to customer service. So it would hold companies and management financially liable for any preventable deaths caused by their inaction in disaster-prone areas. That's big.
Wow, that would mean that these businesses, and more specifically those in charge, lose money if service is out, and especially if that outage leads to a death. How would that work?
Well, a coroner would have to find that a death would have been prevented had the telco acted differently. And if they do, significant financial penalties would have to be applied to the company and its executives. That's, I think, very explosive and kind of hard to enforce too.
Okay, so pretty big things in this bill. What has been the reaction to this draft bill?
So the Communications Alliance, which represents the big telcos, has just said completely unworkable. And so they're really not having a bar of it, although I'm sure there's a lot of lobbying going on behind the background. There have been 17 MPs who've signed the bill, so that's got support. But again, it doesn't guarantee that it goes on to the notice paper. Only the executive of government will determine whether it's taken up. So at the moment, it's a draft bill. It's open for submissions. People can write to Lisa. Other MPs and backbenchers can talk to Lisa about the bill, but unless the communications minister takes it up, it's got no hope.
So it's unlikely that this bill will go anywhere. I mean, if no one champions this issue and coverage doesn't improve, what will we see?
Increasingly, I mean, telecommunications is, I think, getting close to a right in Australia, given how much you need to do through your mobile phone, through the internet. So many government services now are pretty well impossible to access without internet connections. Schools, education increasingly, universities, telehealth, all of these services that governments are saying to regional areas, this technology is going to fix this because you won't need a specialist doctor in your hometown. You will be able to deliver this through telehealth. Mm. All of these issues require connectivity. And so it's no longer a luxury. It is now a staple of day-to-day living in rural and regional areas.
I just think it's 2021, you know, we do live rurally, but we're also not completely remote. I think it's within our rights to have access to mobile phone reception. I just still find it staggering that in this day and age we don't. And I think there's a bit of a sense of this is how things have always been. If you live in out in the bush, that this is what life is like. You expect to not have mobile reception rather than a mentality of, well, if we can't approach it from everyone should have mobile reception, then how do we fix it? Rather than coming from a place of this is just what life in the bush is like and you've got to learn to live with it.
Thanks to Will and Hannah for their time on this episode. You can find more of Gabby Chan's reporting at theguardian.com, and we've linked some of her pieces on this issue on the Full Story page as well. This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria, sound design by Joe Koning, and mixing by Camilla Hannan. The executive producers of Full Story are Gabrielle Jackson, Miles Martignoni, Melanie Tate, and myself, Laura Murphy-Oates. Okay, catch you tomorrow.